You need to be cooperative with others. You need to understand differences instead of pitting people against one another, ensuring that they don't use hate speech or dehumanizing language against other groups or even othering people. So there's a lot that you can do on all different levels to prevent atrocities.
Welcome to The Making of Atrocities, Is Racism a Risk Factor? Podcast from the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation, an initiative of the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience that works alongside communities to amplify the voices of survivors and inspire collective action in countries struggling to confront human rights violations. This podcast addresses racism as a risk factor for atrocity crimes on a global scale and within the framework of racial justice and anti-racism. My name is Jordan Wykins, and I am a program associate at the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. I'll be your host for this final episode. The Making of Atrocities, Is Racism a Risk Factor? Is a part of GIJTR's Global Racial Justice Project. The project emphasizes that racial equality requires deliberate attempts to eliminate policies, practices, attitudes, and cultural messages that reinforce unjust treatment based on race and can only be achieved through proactive and preventative measures. Over the course of the project, GIJTR developed 5 case studies focused on Colombia, South Africa, Namibia, Brazil, and Sri Lanka, and developed a policy brief drawing on the case studies with best practices and recommendations for the global community to address racism as a risk factor and identify the linkages to the commission of atrocity crimes. The project culminated in the development of an indicators and assessment tool on racism and atrocity crimes, and accompanying recommendations for local, state, and international stakeholders, along with this 6-part podcast series. Throughout our series, we've discussed major themes in racial justice, from the history of colonization to the role of policing, surveillance, and media, all within the overarching framework of atrocity prevention. So, what have we learned from these discussions? We've provided unsurprising evidence that racism is prevalent in many communities across the globe and highlighted that racial injustice does not always look the same in every context, and therefore racial justice cannot take on a one-size-fits-all form. We've seen the economic and social impacts of racial inequality. We've heard stories of the effects of disparate treatment, including unequal access to fundamental resources such as healthcare and education. So, what happens now? What do our lessons learned provide us with? In partnership with the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, GIJTR has developed tangible resources to address racism as a risk factor in atrocity crimes. The Indicators and Assessment Tool on Racism and Atrocity Crimes and accompanying recommendations are a set of tools that create a common language to address how we as a global society talk about the extent of the effects of racism. To conclude our series, I'm joined by Jacqueline Straitfield Hall, Director of Policy and Research at the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, to discuss the IAT and recommendations, their development and their uses, and the future of such a tool. We believe these resources answer the question behind every episode in this series. Yes, racism is a risk factor in atrocity crimes. Jacqueline, thank you for joining us. To begin our conversation, I'd like to ask you to explain the goal or mission of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect and how you became involved in the organization.
The mission of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect is to influence governments, the UN, and other policymakers to uphold this concept called the Responsibility to Protect, which is really about protecting populations from 4 mass atrocity crimes, which are genocide, war crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. R2P was adopted by heads of state and government at the UN in 2005 during the UN World Summit. And the Global Center was founded a few years later, really with the idea of trying to mobilize action around this concept and ensure that the international community never again fails to protect populations from those crimes. It was really motivated by the genocide in Rwanda and in Srebrenica in the 1990s. And the fact that many felt that the international community failed in its responsibility to prevent or respond to those genocides. And so the Global Center does advocacy work, policy work, and also community building with states around this concept of prevention of mass atrocity crimes. And I joined the center in 2010. I was actually an intern at the time and have slowly worked my way up in the organization over the past 14 years. I was a grad student at the time, just teaching international relations courses and interested in failures of the Security Council, failure in Rwanda, and found the organization at a time when they needed help and I was interested in the topic. And so I joined on then and haven't left.
Great. Thank you. So what are the roles of international and local stakeholders in atrocity prevention?
So under R2P, the primary responsibility for atrocity prevention is with the state. The state has a role in protecting its own population from atrocities, and it also has a role in not perpetrating abuses itself. So this role can take many forms, from very long-term prevention strategies that involve structural reforms of national institutions to more short-term actions when evidence of risk is imminent, such as if they see rising tensions between two communities, the state has a responsibility to step in and try and mitigate whatever grievances the communities have. The international community really has multifaceted roles in atrocity prevention. If you're thinking about atrocities very specifically, responding to atrocities, there are a lot of options the international community has to prevent crimes as they see them starting to emerge. So this ranges from international justice mechanisms like ICC referrals to punitive measures like adopting sanctions or authorizing interventions to more cooperative measures like mediation, extending good offices, really working with the states to convince them that behavior needs to change or institutions need to change in order to prevent atrocities. Now, that's kind of international community, big picture, whether you're talking about states or the UN as a big global community. Obviously, there are individual actors within the international community who can act in certain ways, monitors, looking at different risks. In the Human Rights Council, they have special procedures who are in charge of monitoring specific country situations or thematic issues, and they can raise the alarm on atrocity risks. So those are more individual roles in atrocity prevention. And then on a kind of more local level, community level engagement with atrocity prevention, there's a lot that civil society can do to prevent atrocities, whether it be monitoring what's happening in their community and raising alarm with decision makers within their governments, raising alarm even at the local level with community leaders. We talk a lot about the role that kind of religious leaders or civil society leaders who are kind of prominent figures in their communities can do around messaging with communities. And as tensions arise, messaging that you need to be cooperative with others, you need to understand differences instead of pitting people against one another, ensuring that they don't use hate speech or dehumanizing language against other groups or even othering people for that matter. So there's a lot that you can do on all different levels to prevent atrocities. And I would just add that these are things that kind of are more direct and directly prevent atrocities. There's also plenty that you can do to prevent the factors that contribute to atrocities. So, for example, we talk a lot about how economic inequality is very common in countries that have conditions that are conducive to atrocities. And so adopting measures that deal with that inequality also in the long term help contribute to atrocity prevention, even if it's not a very direct thing.
So to kind of jump into the work that's being done on this project, generally speaking, for someone who isn't familiar with these documents, what is an indicator and assessment tool and what uses does such a tool have?
So indicator and assessment tool is essentially a somewhat, I won't say completely, but a somewhat comprehensive list of risk factors. In this case, it's a list of risk factors for atrocities that looks specifically at how racism is a risk factor for atrocities. So this sort of a tool can be utilized in a number of ways. One is to help raise awareness of how things we see every day, from discriminatory policies to use of derogatory language to racially motivated attacks by police or other actors, contribute to conditions within a country that enable the commission of atrocities. So that's very basically, you can use it as an awareness tool to say, hey, here's a list of risk factors for atrocities. Here are the things on that list that exist in our country that we should think about addressing. And it's just awareness raising at that point. It can also be used as an analytical tool where you look at how the various risk factors are coupled within a country and how those kind of overlaying of risk factors and other conditions may lead to an escalation in risk, or where you identify what risk factors are highest and build policy recommendations around how to confront those risks. So this toolkit in particular is meant to demonstrate that while the existence of racism in and of itself will not result in atrocity crimes, it's a combination of different risk factors and indicators that exacerbate societal divisions, enable and create a permissive environment for the perpetration of escalating abuses by state and non-state forces, and together create the conditions for atrocities to occur. I would say there's no set number of indicators you must have added together in order to have a clear atrocity risk. You really have to look at the indicators and assess the severity of the actions that you're seeing within the tool. So it's really meant to give you something to think about, a broad set of ideas about how things that you see in society may contribute to the risk of atrocities through that lens of where racism contributes to risk.
How was this IAT developed and what resources does it draw from?
So this IAT was developed and modeled after an existing toolkit called the UN Framework of Analysis for Atrocity Crimes. The Framework of Analysis, which we use heavily in the atrocity prevention community, looks at risk factors for all four atrocity crimes. And we have developed this tool to look specifically at the conditions under which racism and racist policies and practices increase the risk of atrocities in a society. The UN Framework of Analysis is set up in a very similar manner. It has a number of broad risk factors. And under each risk factor, it lists indicators of how you would measure that risk or think about that risk. And so we've done basically the same thing here. We came up with 13 broad risk factors for atrocity crimes that are specific to racism, and then listed under each risk factor a set of indicators to help in assessing when a situation, when policies, when behaviors are escalating. And then we also provide kind of an explanatory context for when these indicators combine with other societal factors from the other framework may result in atrocities. So in order to make this document, we mapped out risk factors for atrocities we thought would be most directly connected to racism, and then spent a lot of time thinking about patterns of behavior by governments, government actors, security forces, police, as well as individuals in society to construct this sort of list of ways in which racism is operationalized in a manner that could create an environment conducive to these actors perpetrating atrocity crimes against a particular racial or ethnic group.
I do want to jump into talking a little bit about the recommendations that come from it. How can the IAT and accompanying recommendations be utilized by civil society organizations, local governments, and international organizations?
So the end of the IAT, because it goes a step beyond just listing risk factors, we've also provided a list of recommendations for how individual actors could respond to risk factors once they've identified them. And so within that, we've broken it into three big categories of actors. States, because as I mentioned, with atrocity prevention, we think about the primary responsibility of the state. Next is the United Nations and regional organizations. And then finally, local, national, and international civil society. In states, a lot of the recommendations are focused on addressing social, economic inequality, and then dismantling structures and systems that perpetuate racism, perpetuate biases within society. They're focused on a number of different issue areas, ranging from security sector reform to adopting international treaties and other mechanisms that address racism and discrimination and a lot of atrocity relevant policies. It also includes things like reforming the education sector to ensure there's no bias in the way that youth are being taught about different cultures, how they're being taught about the country's history, and how that history relates to racism and xenophobia and the structures within society today. And then for United Nations and regional organizations, we focused a lot on how they can monitor what's happening in countries, as well as how they can assist countries in addressing these structures and practices to ensure that they don't continue into the future. Because one element of atrocity prevention is responding to imminent risks. And another element in terms of helping states is really about providing some form of assistance to a state that is receptive to change. And so that's really how the recommendations for the UN and regional organizations is written, is coming from a place of, when you've identified risks in a country, how can you assist them in instituting reforms to ensure that racism does not contribute to atrocity risks, and to ensuring that racism does not continue within that country for that matter. And then also reforming their own structures and systems to ensure that they're not also perpetuating a lot of these issues. So ensuring that there's diversity within the organizations themselves. And then for local, national, international civil society, a lot of the recommendations are focused on how to call attention to these issues within societies, and also how to encourage governments to make reforms. So what messages need to be articulated about changing educational programs, about changing socioeconomic setups in a country to ensure that the conditions for atrocities are no longer there, creating spaces for dialogue, creating spaces for transitional justice if it's needed. Who are you empowering within a society to ensure that their voices are heard to prevent atrocities in the future?
Great, thank you. How do we go about distributing this toolkit, making sure that it gets to the correct people? What are the sort of next steps in that process?
I think that a lot of what's in this toolkit are recommendations that can be applied at any time, anywhere. I think that we often say no country is immune to mass atrocity crimes. I would say that's probably also true of racism in our current global context, that there are no countries that can say that they're completely racism-free, completely non-xenophobic. And so I think that all governments, all organizations could benefit from looking at the toolkit, from looking at the list of risk factors, and really having kind of an internal thought process around it. That said, I think there are kind of strategic moments where you could distribute such a tool, where you could share it with governments or use it, if you're civil society, use it to target governments with recommendations. So in our work, a lot of times that would include thinking about the UPR process, Universal Periodic Review process, which is a time where states can provide other recommendations to other states. It's a peer review process on how they're performing on human rights. So you could think about, how are you performing on decreasing the impact of racism on the population? How are you performing on ensuring that racist structures are not contributing to the risk of atrocity crimes? So ahead of universal periodic review sessions is a good example of a time to distribute the toolkit, a time to encourage states and civil society to use it. I know that there are other UN mechanisms that focus on racism, including the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, the Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, and others, and making sure it makes its way through their networks, through their meetings, and is something that they can promote as a tool for not just assisting them in their work, but a tool through which they can find a common language with civil society, with others within governments, around where racism contributes to other risks in society. And I think that would be something that's really interesting to states, to populations, because I feel that it's a language that's often missing. People know that racism is a problem, and I don't know if they know fully how to articulate the full extent of that problem. And so being able to find a common language through a tool like this could be beneficial both at the UN level as well as the local level.
Great. Thanks so much. Thanks for listening to The Making of Atrocities, Is Racism a Risk Factor? A podcast from the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience. And a special thank you to our guest this episode, Jacqueline Streatfield Hall. I've been your host, Jordan Watkins. To access the resources mentioned during this episode, along with additional toolkits and policy briefs, please visit our website at www.gijtr.org. The International Coalition of Sites of Conscience is a global network of over 350 historic sites, museums, and memory initiatives in more than 65 countries, all dedicated to using past struggles to address social injustice today. This podcast is brought to you by the Global Initiative for Justice, Truth, and Reconciliation, GIJTR for short, which is a flagship program led by the International Coalition of Sites of Conscience and consisting of 8 additional global organizations committed to promoting just and sustainable peace in conflict and post-conflict countries. GIJTR does this in a participatory, inclusive, and holistic manner, building the capacity of survivors and local civil society organizations to foster locally led initiatives that promote memory, truth, and justice.